We're live.
Okay. Hello, I'm Simon Mercep. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, television, theatre, anything else that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and me lately.
And not just Simon and me, to be fair, this time. When the occasion demands, we can call upon other insightful, profound and talented observers of popular culture, which is exactly what we've had to rely on this week.
We certainly have. In fact, just last night, Saturday night, this is Sunday morning, neither of us could quite make it to Auckland's Mount Smart Stadium to catch the Canadian wonder kid Justin Bieber in concert. Personally, Steve, I was beside myself with disappointment not to make it.
Oh, the heartbreak is evident in your voice, Simon. I can hear it.
I know.
To be honest, it's not entirely my thing. It's not quite my tempo either. So I decided that I would hand over reviewing duties to my wife, Debbie, who
brave woman.
Entirely share my musical taste. But she was delighted to go. She is, dare I say, a believer.
Please, we will. One thing Steve and I did manage to catch at the same time this last week or so was the screening, the media screening of another huge figure in entertainment, as big as a building, in fact, an ape. In the film Kong Skull Island.
Yes. Now, of course, not all we see on the screen is as diverting and as entertaining as that. Now, sometimes it can sit rather uncomfortably and it can reflect current events in our own society. Now, this, I gather, Simon, is very much the case with the current series of Broadchurch crime drama.
Absolutely. We'll get to that a little later too, Steve, and there's quite a bit to chew over with that one. And then, of course, you have programmes which at first blush appear certainly well produced and acted and thought out and serious and, dare I say, intelligent. And then once you realize what the topic is that they're actually dealing with, you're not so sure. And I think for you, that was the case with this Netflix series called The OA.
Yes. In the end, it had me going, oh, eh? but we'll come to that later. We'll start with something that was a bit fresher. And so
absolutely.
I'm going to go over to Debbie, who is discussing Justin Bieber on Sunday morning while the last notes of last night's Justin Bieber concert are still echoing around Mount Smart Stadium.
Absolutely. I think, Debbie, if we were giving out prizes for dedication to duty, you would be our first recipient. Hello. Welcome to Crave.
Thanks, Simon.
Okay, so a lot of anticipation around this. What were your overall impressions of Justin Bieber?
Well, overall, I thought it was a great concert. I'm a Justin Bieber fan, to be fair, although I am not a teenager. I happen to be in my extremely late 30s, so...
Sure.
But I have seen him four times, twice in America and twice in New Zealand.
Okay, so you've got a bit of a history to draw some comparisons from there. So how did this show overall compare to what you'd seen before?
I thought it was good, but not the best concert I've seen of Justin Bieber.
Okay, so what was the good bits?
The good bits, I thought that, what were the good bits? I guess overall, he's just a great performer. So there was a lot of stage presence. There was a lot of, special effects, things like that.
Okay.
Props,
for someone who doesn't know him and knows what he's like on stage, I mean, is he a good dancer? Does he relate well to the audience? Is there a lot of, talking with people? Give us a sense of that. What sort of show he puts on?
Yeah, he's a great dancer. He also plays guitar. He did his own drum solo, which was excellent. He's definitely a great musician. He has a beautiful voice. So on the somewhat unplugged, obviously not fully unplugged, but on the somewhat unplugged versions, he was great. He's wonderful to listen to. He has dancers on stage, so that's quite entertaining when he's not actually dancing.
Okay. Is he essentially what we're hearing here is pop music? What's the best description?
Yes, I'd say he's definitely a pop artist.
Okay. And I noticed that you've it's not just pure but pop. You mentioned the dance, electronic dance. Is he pretty cutting edge on that side of things, is he?
Yes. Yeah, he definitely had some EDM elements in his show last night.
Huh. What about the songs themselves? What sort of a selection did he present?
Well, he did have new songs from his latest album, which I guess would be the purpose album. I'm not sure. Yeah. It was the Purpose Tour. And he played some old favorites like Baby, one of his very first hits, and things like Boyfriend, songs like that from his previous tours.
What about the crowd, Debbie? I mean, Mount Smart can hold a lot of people. I think they can get 40 or 50,000 there if they really try very hard. How big was it, and what sort of spread of ages were there in the audience?
I'm guessing it was probably around 40,000 people, and most of them were young women, probably between the ages of 14 and 19, perhaps. I'm just guessing. There were some definite parents there, myself included.
I mean, of course, because isn't he just one of the artists of the social media generation, isn't he?
I guess he would be, yeah.
Yeah, I think I think he started on YouTube. I think that's where he got his big... Yeah. So, okay, so what was it then? You mentioned that, you know, it was a great show, but perhaps not quite as good as some of the others you'd seen. Where did you feel he didn't quite...
I think some of his songs seemed quite generic. So, I don't know. Maybe it was less relatable for me. I'm not sure why. There was a few less upbeat songs. I tend to like his really upbeat songs, so I was missing that. He seems to have evolved from a very pop artist with very flamboyant costumes and really upbeat, heavy numbers to maybe going back to who he really is, a little bit slower songs. He's got a great voice, so he was highlighting that, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
But his look was very interesting last night. He came out with some rather dorky glasses that were strapped onto his head with a black strap in the back. He was wearing a mechanics jacket with his name, Justin, imprinted on the left breast. And actually rather tame trousers. Usually he wears rather odd clothes, but this time he looked pretty generic. So he looked what I considered a bit dorktastic, to be honest.
Oh, I've heard that expression before, dorktastic.
Yeah.
I'll store that one for future use. Yeah. And did he kind of say anything about being in New Zealand to the local fans?
Oh, gosh, I don't really remember him saying that. He doesn't talk a lot. You asked me about that earlier. And he does a bit. He did have a bit of his own philosophy there. And to be honest, I don't usually look to 20-something pop artists for my philosophy. But he did talk about how one needs to have a purpose in life and how, you know, everyone's important. And no matter how old you are or how young you are, you have a purpose in life.
Et cetera. Yeah, actually, I was just doing a little bit of reading, Debbie, this morning. Yeah. And I mean, he at one time, I'm not sure he still is, he was very squeaky clean, wasn't he, his image initially. And I think he was a Christian. Maybe he still is a Christian. Oh, but he's kind of, in recent times, he's had a few run-ins with the law on various, you know, driving charges and whatnot. And do you get a sense that that's all just, I don't know, a teenager growing up?
That's what I always thought. I mean, honestly, I don't pay a lot of attention to favorite artists and their personal life. I'm more interested in how well they perform on stage and how much they can entertain me.
Yeah. So on the basis of what you saw last night, should he return, would you go again?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what about your erstwhile husband? Do you think you've persuaded him to come along with you?
No, it might be a bit embarrassing to have him next to me.
Uh-huh. Okay. On that note, Debbie, thank you so much. Really appreciate that for to Mount Smart Stadium.
Could I put a quick note about the opening acts?
Yes, please.
Very quick. Shepherd, an Australian band, were absolutely excellent. I loved them. I had never heard of them before, but I am compelled to download one of their albums now.
And what sort of style are they?
Pop music, really.
Shepherd, that's with two P's in the middle, I understand.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And Martin Garrix was an EDM artist, and he was quite a bit of fun. Really got the crowd excited and revved up for Justin.
Fantastic. Hey, thank you. And thank you for the recommendations.
Sure.
Okay. Steve McCabe, having listened to all that, you'll be rushing out to get a ticket again, won't you?
Well, I don't know. I'm torn here. I have to be absolutely honest. I dropped my girls off last night to go and see this concert, and I thought that I was making the really smart move by driving away. The music's not my style, but Deb makes a very, very compelling point when she's trying to convince me that you and I need to branch out a little bit more. You know, the world does not begin and end with Bruce Springsteen or the Rolling Stones.
Doesn't it?
Apparently not. Other bands whose heyday was, you know, before the entire Justin Bieber audience were even born. And it brought to mind the review that you did last year of 21 Pilots.
Yes, I was just thinking that as you said that. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Because it's not what you or I would have imagined would be our thing, so to speak. We are both of an age where we tend to know what we like and like what we know and stick with that. And while I have to say, when I listen to Justin Bieber's music recorded, I think, oh dear Lord, this is dreary, this is rubbish, and I have no interest in it. Increasingly, I'm being won over by Deb's perspective, which says that live music in and of itself is just a good thing.
I think you're right, actually. And there's something about being at a show, a live show, and absorbing the whole performance, which is not just about the song. It's about everything else that gets wrapped up in it. And you're absolutely right. Listening to Deb, I had that 21 Pilots concert in my mind because I went into that show last year really not knowing anything about them. And because I had no expectations, I was really very, very pleasantly surprised. And I thought this was fantastic. And it's really interesting for people of our generation to put ourselves in a slightly uncomfortable position amongst a much younger crowd and just kind of get a sense of what's happening out there for younger people. So that's all very good.
So I think the moral of the story here is I think the old folkies like you and I definitely need to start broadening our minds a little.
Continuing to broaden is what I'm going to say. That yes, you're absolutely right.
Hey, I'll see you down the mosh pit at the next Justin Bieber concert. That
That's right. We'll both be there.
Looking forward to it. We're going to stand out like I can't even imagine.
We'll just pretend we've got some youngster that we're chaperoning, but they're lost somewhere.
Yeah, we'll do that. Now, Debbie's not the only guest helping us out here on Crave just recently. We've both been fairly busy, and so if you take a look over at our website, cravepodcast.com, you'll find Taylor Moss. Now, she was delighted to get the opportunity to review one of her favourite bands, Pixies, who played at Auckland's Vector Arena just recently. Now, to read Taylor's review, it sounds like we missed a heck of a show.
Sure does.
She definitely left feeling very, very satisfied after that show.
Yeah, I liked her description of, among other things, how at one point some band members threw drumsticks at each other and caught them and carried on playing.
Now, that's quite a trick, isn't it?
Yeah, and she clearly sounds like she was in the middle of a very, very enthusiastic crowd. And Steve, I couldn't help but note when she said it was great, but every now and then she got stuck beside someone a bit taller in front of her.
Yeah, not really a problem you and I face too much.
No, I was just thinking that you and I sometimes probably cause a degree of inconvenience to others. That happened just recently, actually. Where was I? Somewhere at the front. Oh, what was it? Oh, yeah, it was a Springsteen concert. That's right. Yeah.
Yes. The fortunate thing about that was I could actually see exactly where you were because the two of us do tend to stand out. It works quite nicely. Now, I did notice you couldn't help yourself there. You had to work in a Springsteen reference. Look, here's the deal. He's gone. He's left our shores. And the stage he played on is now being occupied by Justin Bieber. You need to deal with that.
I do. Okay, I won't mention Bruce in our next podcast. I'll just wait till he returns to this country.
Yeah, right. Now, in the meantime, we don't know if St. Bruce, of sainted memory, will be back. I mean, you know, he is getting on, but we know someone we just can't get. You can't keep a good ape down, can you?
No.
We know who's coming back, and obviously it's the ape formerly known as King Kong.
Yes.
Now simply Kong.
Ooh.
Yeah, he's been reimagined, hasn't he?
Yes, and upsized.
Oh, yes. You can never have too much Kong. So we saw this at a media screening, didn't we?
Yeah. This is Kong Skull Island. And, at the media screening, I have to say, we did have the benefit of the full 3D experience because it was 3D, but also on this big IMAX screen, the huge screen in Auckland. So that certainly emphasized, the grandeur of this the big fella when he finally appears in the film. Steve, it did have its big budget moments of action, and I thought there was one particularly nice performance from a very talented character actor, but gosh, it had its share of disappointments. And I don't think you were particularly swept away either, were you?
It was rubbish.
Oh, okay. No, okay.
There's no sense whatsoever in dressing this up. It was a mess from start to finish. I mean, how many different films were going on in the middle of that film?
Yeah, there were one or two, I have to say. Shall we? I mean, even trying to summarize the story is not an easy thing to do, but I dare you to try.
Okay, right. let's see. We start off mid Second World War with American and Japanese fighter pilots, one of each, crash landing on an island somewhere in the middle of the Pacific. Just as they're about to fight to the death, suddenly they are distracted from their mortal combat by a dirty great big ape putting them off their stride.
As it would.
We then cut to an intriguingly promising little selection of newsreel snippets that sort of trace American political history from the end of the war up to the next, well, one of the later wars the Americans fought, this one in Vietnam. And then we cut to John Goodman getting out of a car saying, well, at least we can be sure that Washington will never get more messed up than it is right now. Which was,
right,
I think, possibly shoehorned in at the very last minute when they realised that they could get a cheap laugh out of that one.
Yes.
And so then we get Goodman, who acts as a character named Bill Rander, who works for some possibly governmental, we're not quite sure, agency who go off and explore unexplored places. And one of them is Skull Island. You have to say it like that, don't you?
You do. And here we are, you know, well into the 1970s, still a place on planet Earth where they can't get to it. They haven't been able to. Isn't that amazing?
And they say it's the last one on Earth that it's been found by these newfangled spy satellite thingies that are now being put up there by the Russians as well as the Americans. And apparently there's permanently a storm going on around Skull Island, which is why it's never been penetrated, except obviously by the two fighter pilots earlier in the film who did
exactly
penetrate quite the storm and survive.
And so, I seem to recall the sky being quite clear at that point.
Oh, don't be difficult.
Oh, all right, sorry.
You're not supposed to pay attention to details like that.
Righto,
so,
fair enough.
So they then go off to Vietnam. Rather conveniently, the Vietnam War has just ended. And so Samuel L. Jackson, as Lieutenant Colonel Packard, has still got a squad, a troop, a century, whatever you call them, of ragtag, slightly maverick soldiers, because they're always a bit ragtag and maverick, aren't they?
They are.
Who happen to have a totally unspecified number of helicopters available.
For
use to go and explore the eponymous
Island.
Skull
yes.
Island.
Yes.
And off they go. And you can tell I'm starting to lose my will to live even talking.
Yeah, I know. So they're taking said scientist, but they need a tracker, don't they? They need someone expert in a tracker. And so up pops Tom Hiddleston, British.
So where would you go? If you need to find a tracker to get you through an unknown land, where would you go and find one?
Oh, I'm sure I'd be looking for Tom Hiddleston.
First thing you do is you go to some dodgy bar in the ground floor of a brothel in Saigon. That's the first place I'd go. And
yes.
I would just look, because I want someone who can find his way through a jungle. I'd look, first quality I'd look for is a bloke who's tasty in a fist fight.
Yeah.
So you've got Tom Hiddleston, who's basically thinking he's doing his audition for the next James Bond film.
Oh, totally. Yes.
And he's actually looking quite good at the beginning of the film. And then there's Brie Larson as a photojournalist, who they also drag along. And off they go. And Kong takes exception to them arriving on his island. Are we going to mention the bizarre twist it takes about 45 minutes in that had both of us going, you what?
Oh, is this about the origin of the other, I can think we can say this, the other creatures? Is that what you're referring to?
Where they come from? And it's that one particular character who just appears out of nowhere. I think this is the one you were referring to as the character actor.
Yes. Well, we can say who he is. John C. Reilly is the actor.
Yeah.
And he makes a rather comedic entrance. I thought, actually, by the end of the film, I was on his side more than anyone else's because he was the most interesting character in there, a human character anyway. That was my view of him.
Well, it was. It turns out he's the American fighter pilot who's
yes.
been stranded on Skull Island, and he's now basically the well, I think we'd have to call him the Rangatira, wouldn't we?
I think we would, yes.
Because the name of the native people he's leading
yes.
were the Iwi.
Yes. Isn't that interesting?
That may be sit up straight.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've given you enough a sense of the plot here. It's, and you mentioned different films because with Samuel L. Jackson and the helicopter gunships, that evokes a certain Vietnam War film effectively.
They didn't miss a single Vietnam War cliche, not a single one. They were all in there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this film really should have been called Viet Cong Skull Island.
Oh, nice. Oh, wow.
I'm so cross. I didn't think of that in time for the review I wrote for our website.
That's a lovely way to put it. Go on. I mean, I just thought, Steve, not only in terms of the stories and the imagery and what are you watching, and the story does get a bit convoluted. I also thought this is something
that did kind of convoluted.
The other thing that really struck me was, to me, some of the actors were just playing their roles completely at odds with each other.
Yeah.
You mentioned Tom Hiddleston. He did have a promising beginning, but really, as the film went on, he had less and less to say, and he just kind of negotiated his way through with the same sort of, you know, setting his jaw, determined to look heroic no matter what was in front of him, and not really giving us much. There wasn't much we knew about his character, where he came from. He sort of got a bit close to the Brie Larson character, but didn't seem to go anywhere. I thought, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what input he had into how that character came out on screen, but I left feeling a little bit disappointed that not much more was made of that. It was a good opportunity for him to play the hero, but it didn't really go far enough, I thought.
No, he was basically making first of all, he was auditioning for the next Bond film, and then he was in the next Jurassic Park film.
Yeah, and almost, dare I say it, in a sort of B-grade movie, Jurassic Park, because wasn't a lot of acting going on there.
No, not a whole lot, and he was fighting against the most absurd dinosaur monster frozen chickens.
Yes.
They were ridiculous.
And then you compare his approach to, say, Brie Larson, where I thought she was trying to take the role quite seriously, was putting quite a bit into her role, I thought.
Really? I thought she was bored by the end.
Oh, did you? Okay, that's interesting. I thought she...
one line when they look at some large skulls on the ground and she says, "I know a mass grave when I see one. I photographed a lot." She's thinking, like, she's just bored. She's given up. She's realised what an absolute hound of a film she's in. And she's just phoning it in.
I didn't. Okay, well, we differ on that one. Samuel L. Jackson hammed it up big time.
But, you know, I have to say, you know, if you're going to put somebody with weapons-grade acting talent like Samuel Jackson in a film, right, you need to unleash him. And you have to look after this film. All you want to go do is go back and watch something he's done for Quentin Tarantino.
Yes,
and
yes,
see
true.
What this man can do with a powerful script. And you just know there's something about the man's delivery. And it was like watching a sheepdog that's been kept indoors for too long. He was desperate to be allowed off the leash to actually do what he does so well, to be Samuel Jackson. And you could see he was ready to start biting people's ankles and ripping up the furniture. It was killing him.
And then what about John C. Reilly? I mean, in some ways he was camping it up and one of the characters there who clearly wasn't taking things very seriously, but his character was the one character where they did give you some backstory.
Yes.
And so he had some nice lines. He had a lot of interaction with the other characters. In a way, I find the heart of the movie drifted to him much more than the other human actors. In fact, even more than Kong, actually.
Exactly. I mean, it was very much Skull Island. There was a lot of Skull Island and not a huge amount of Kong in this.
And this is the other thing I mentioned in my review, Steve. I wonder what your thoughts were. All the previous Kongs, and there have been a few of them, it's the relationship between Kong and the lead female character, which is really the emotional heart of those early films and drives the story.
Yeah, that goes back to Fay Wray back in 1933.
But in this film, there's a very brief interplay between the Brie Larson character and Kong. I mean, and it's so really that side of it is minimized. And so whatever it is that's driving Kong to act the way he does is minimized. And so he doesn't become, I mean, he's huge and he's full of action, but I didn't feel drawn to his I was going to use the word personality. That's not quite right, but you know what I mean.
Like, I know exactly what you mean.
He was a bit more anonymous in some ways.
Yes, and again, it wasn't really about him. I mean, a lot of the time it was, like we say, the Vietnam War film. And can I just say, when they were doing a lot of the helicopter shots, it was positively balletic. It was beautiful to watch. The editing was. I think that there's one moment when Kong first takes out a helicopter. I don't think we're giving any secrets away here, to say that the there's a wonderful. Scene that echoes in the original King Kong film, the ape at the top of the Empire State Building swatting planes out of the sky.
Yes.
And there's obviously a callback to that early on, just with helicopters this time. And the very first time he takes out a helicopter is actually quite shocking.
Yeah, yep.
Quite stunning.
I agree. Yeah. And
And that, like I say, that's the Apocalypse Now film that Samuel Jackson thought he was making. And that was actually reasonably well done in moments. And there was really sharp editing and very fast, very not gratuitously snappy, but really tight editing combined with some beautiful slow motion footage of the helicopters. I wanted to see that film.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are, I mean, we're dissing this film, but there are some genuinely great visual moments. There is some great special effects, obviously. And if that's your cup of tea, if you just want to see a big, you know, FX blockbuster, you're probably going to get quite a bit out of this, I guess.
Yeah.
That's all well and good. And it does deliver. And I agree with you about the editing. I thought there was some very clever, tight editing that helped it zing along and gave it a different. Yeah, a different feel. So that was all good.
And then you've got the supporting cast who basically play, again, the cliched of undifferentiated Vietnam War soldiers. You know, the down to the cigarette packet in the band of the helmet and the wading through the waist deep water in their t-shirts. You know, it's just a series of cliches. But then you've got one of the soldiers was named Cole. I swear, was he played by Bill English? Looked an awful lot like him. You've got the most gratuitous shoehorning in of a Chinese character as a sop to the Chinese production.
Yeah.
Tianjin, who we last saw in Great Wall, provided nothing whatsoever to the film.
No, not at all. No. And actually, just speaking of that, I thought that you mentioned the opening sequence using the newsreel footage.
Yeah.
That really reminded me of the opening sequence of the most recent Godzilla film, which also had a similar type of opening sequence. And actually, the size of the creatures in this film was very much Godzilla scale size.
Yes.
But so I don't know whether that was some sort of subtle pitch at the Asian market. I don't know. But had you seen the Peter Jackson version about 10 years ago, Steve?
No, I didn't.
Okay. I mean, that had a very, very well-remarked fight scene between Kong and two T-Rexes.
Oh, wow.
In that film that went on and on, was very choreographed to it within an inch of its life and was spectacular. And as good as this sequence is in this film, the big showdown between this Kong and his bête noire, I think Jackson might have slightly outdone him, just by the by. So they're great special effects, but I think the Kiwi did pretty well in the previous film too. Anyway,
would think that, wouldn't you? Incidentally,
I would.
A quick tip of the hat to Toby Kebbell, who you possibly wouldn't know by name.
Yeah.
But he played both one of the ragtag bunch of Maverick soldiers.
Yes.
And also he played Kong.
Get out.
He was the man in the suit full of little buttons that they have in front of a green screen.
Yes. Okay. Okay. As Andy Serkis did with Gollum and all that sort of thing.
Precisely.
Yeah.
We're on the same page there, yes.
Yeah. So okay.
He's worth a quick mention. And also worth a mention, just because we have to mention this, I have to say, one of the worst scripts I've heard in a film in a long time.
Oh, that's a big claim. Yeah.
Well, I can say there's just an awful lot of very plodding, very ponderous proclamations that just didn't quite work. I mean, I'm pulling my notebook out here because I actually wrote them down while we were there because I wanted to get it just right. I mean, you know, one of them says, "No man comes back from war." Not really. I know. Ooh. It's profound stuff, isn't it? Where are we looking? What else have we got? "It had no conscience, no reasoning, just destroy." Yeah. I mean, seriously, you know, so somebody actually got paid for writing this, and that makes me cross. It really does. So, yeah, it, like you say, fantastic special effects. I mean, it looks gorgeous. Although, yeah. do you notice they couldn't even decide how big Kong was? You know, at one point, they've got his handprint or his paw prints or his whatever you call it. Do they have paws or hands?
Feet. I don't know. Go on.
Okay,
yeah,
whatever
something
it's
like
called. Look, you know, handprint that's on the side of a cliff.
Ah, true. Yes. And that's, yes. And that is huge.
It's monstrously huge. And then shortly after that, Brie Larson gets her Fay Wray moment, which gives you a sense of the size of said upper extremity. And it's a fraction of that size.
Yeah, that's true.
They never quite figured out how big this animal was. I mean, if we're getting into details, like I mentioned the helicopters before, they sailed toward Kong Skull Island on a transport ship, and I think there's four or five helicopters on the deck of this ship. By the time they got through the storm, there's a dozen of them. It's helicopter multiplying storm. That's pretty.
Oh, yes.
Pretty impressive.
Oh, I know. Oh, what they could get away with in those days, I tell you.
Yeah. So I think to be blunt here, I really, really wouldn't waste my money on a ticket, would you?
When I saw it, the trailer and the publicity, I probably would have gone to see it. I would have been just curious to see how they interpret Kong, you know, just to see how he looks this time around. And I think I was quite interested to see, Steve, how Tom Hiddleston went, because I thought I'd read that, you know, he probably was, he's been touted as a possible Bond, and here he was in a hero role. And I think I was, would have been interested to see how he handled that, just out of curiosity. And also Brie Larson, who's won an Oscar. So I probably would have gone along, and I would have come away being a bit rather disappointed. That's the answer.
Brie Larson is so much better than this. And basically Tom Hiddleston just like sort of put his hair and his biceps on autopilot and phoned the whole thing in.
Yeah, that's sadly true. Yeah.
So anyway, so Kong, what do you reckon? Would you buy a ticket? Would you recommend?
I think if you just want some mindless entertainment, just for effects, sure. But if you want to keep looking for a bit cleverer, big budget film, probably you wouldn't. That would be my thought.
I think that's fair. So I say it's fairly disposable entertainment and not to be taken seriously.
No.
I would say you could flip those two adjectives round to describe the British crime drama Broadchurch. Now, you're quite taken with this, aren't you?
Yes, I've written about it. I wrote a review on our website, the Crave website. That's cravepodcast.com.
Nice plug, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. After the first episode, and I've got a bit more to say about it, Steve, having watched episode two. I don't know if you're at all familiar with it. This is the third series now. It is it's a very well produced, directed. It's got great actors. The script is good. The first series made a really big impact here as well as in the UK. I mean, it was very good at keeping you guessing as who the bad guy was. Now, the first two series are all about a murder, and this time around it's different, but it's. In my first review, Steve, after the first episode, I said, "Look, great, but I just had a little bit of a question in the back of my mind whether it was starting to be too repetitive in its storytelling devices." But actually, after the second episode and the third one's tonight, those questions have kind of been pushed to one side, but just the force of the story that it's telling.
Yeah, and I did notice on your website that they've slightly shifted gears, haven't they, really, in terms of the story that they are telling. Conventionally, it's always been that shows like this have been about murders.
Yeah.
Murder is the ultimate transgression. It's the great crime.
Yes.
And this time it's about a sexual assault, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is really sort of starting to. Oh, how do I say this without trivializing it?
Yeah, I know. It's difficult.
Becoming popular, but that's a horrible way of putting it.
But it's hard to ignore.
Yeah, there you go. we'll take that. Yeah, it's very, very prominent in the press now. People are finally starting to realize that, it's not murder, but it's still a crime to be taken seriously. And obviously we've got episodes even involving high school students in Wellington lately.
Yeah,
Incitement to all manner of horrific sexual assaults. And so maybe it's time that this – well, okay, here's a question we have to ask. Do we allow that this is fodder for entertainment?
That is very much the question in your mind as you watch the series. Because, Steve, as I was watching, particularly the second episode, I was thinking about that Wellington case that you've just mentioned, all that. Remember that a year or two back in Auckland, there were those teenage boys bragging of, you know, sexual misdemeanors in the Broastbusters. That was awful.
That was nauseating, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think it was as a result of this Wellington case. I think just the last week there was a senior principal in New Zealand saying, you know, schools have to rethink their whole idea of what they teach in sexual health. Should it spend less time on the biological mechanics and more time on social considerations? And then in the last week or two, again, you know, it's not just young males. We had this New Zealand actor in his mid-40s who's now before the courts, accused of several charges of indecent assault. He denies those charges. So it's just rumbles along, and you're thinking, okay, this is kind of current affairs and drama at the same time. I don't know.
And in, you know, life imitating art as usual. Obviously, it's very rare to see an actor up on murder charges.
Yeah.
But we are routinely these days seeing actors, entertainers, up on charges and often convictions.
You know, yep.
Rolf Harris has been convicted. Bill Cosby, I do wonder how soon he's going to get convicted of serial sex crimes.
Yes, yes.
And even at the Oscars, even at that level, there were suggestions that possibly Casey Affleck might not quite get the plaudits that he did with sexual harassment charges floating around him. Now, they've been settled out of court.
Yeah, they have. I think he denied them, but then they were settled, and we don't know too much about that. But it was interesting that when he won and he took to the stage, the woman who presented him with the prize, this Brie Larson, by the way, she pointedly and noticeably did not applaud or clap when he took to the stage. So sexual behavior, the matter of consent, it's real, you know, it's a current issue that in the real world. And to come back to your question, Steve, about whether this can at all be fit into a piece of entertainment, let's get back to the fictional story of Broadchurch.
Yes, there was a point. Yes, yeah, so because this is Crave, the well-known current affairs and serious Weighty Matters podcast.
It is indeed, and we've got some credence there. Now, look, in this story, we have the return of Detective Alex Hardy. He's played by David Tennant, and the return of Detective Ellie Miller, played by Olivia Colman. As you say, Steve, this time around, they're dealing with a complaint of rape by a local woman called Trish. Trish is played by the actress Julie, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name correctly, Hesmond-Haug or something like that. She is well known to many here in the UK because she was for many years on Coronation Street. Now, two episodes in, we've got several suspects in play. So the producers are keeping the suspense and the mystery aspect of all this humming along. But the writers are very cleverly drawing out how society views a complaint like this. So some of the cast, some of the characters are sympathetic to Trish. Some are not, and some are just not sure. She's accused by one character of drinking too much and being too promiscuous. You know, what does that mean? She admits to having had sex with someone new she met online. Well, what does that mean? Does that go anywhere in terms of assessing her actual complaint? And then the other thing they do very well and is they kind of show us what a woman has to go through just to make the complaint. A lot of detail around the physical examination. They don't make it very easy to watch, and I guess that's the point of it. So there's a lot of credit here, I think, to the program makers. They're due a lot of credit for just being pretty honest and taking on a subject like this, and they are able to still give us a riveting mystery. So they have managed to combine the two by giving it a very strong sense of honesty in this, and on that score, it is doing both the things. It's answering both the questions you put to me, Steve. It is entertaining because it's a riveting mystery.
Yeah.
But it is more than that. It is quite uncomfortable and disturbing because you know that what this character is going through, many, many other women will have and will continue to go through out there in the real world. And by the way, I just looked this morning, I just checked on the TVNZ On Demand website. As far as I could see, both the first two episodes are still available to watch, so you could still catch up with the series. I really do recommend it.
Sounds,
so there you go.
Definitely like one to invest a bit of time in. Now, I have, as you were discussing that, and I was absolutely fascinated by the sound of it. I also looked up how to pronounce.
Help me. Yes.
Well, obviously, this being English, you know, it's spelled Hesmondhalg, but it's pronounced Smith. apparently, it's pronounced Hesmondhalsch.
Halsch. Okay, I would not have guessed that. Okay, thank you. Hesmondhalsch.
Me neither.
And she does a very good job on the role, I have to say. I'm not the only one who spent a little bit of time in front of a smaller screen. In your case, you've been watching a Netflix show, Steve.
Oh, The OA.
The OA.
Now, you've seen this too, haven't you?
I have. A little while ago, I think you've seen it perhaps a little more recently. At the very beginning of the podcast, I thought, you know, at the first glance, it looks like it's a pretty well put together, serious drama. But then, I don't know, where the story actually takes you is another matter. Would you care to give us your initial thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, let's just say it's getting increasingly difficult to stay au courant these days because shows don't just, like, as Broadchurch is being broadcast right now, and there's a sequential release. On Netflix, which is the production source and the broadcast source for the OA, things get made and just get dumped. So, like, all, I think it's 8 episodes available online right now. Yeah. And so it's sort of making our job of scheduling our reviews a little bit more difficult. But they've not made watching that one very easy either. basic premise, if I can do this, and it's not an easy one.
It's
not an easy one. So you've got a young woman named Prairie, who is found after an attempted suicide, it would appear. She's recovered. She's saved from an attempted suicide, brought home. She's in her, we think, possibly mid to late 20s. She, and this is in the very first episode, her parents come to visit her in hospital. They haven't seen her in years since she's been disappeared. And it turns out that the big shock in their finding her in hospital is that suddenly she can now see again. Because when they had adopted her, she was blind.
Yes.
And so the story then starts to explore, first of all, her childhood in Russia. And then, which is where she was blinded. And then where she's been these several years, we think, if you add it up, it comes to about 6 or 7 years, I believe, that she's been disappeared. And we are led to believe that Prairie, played by Britt Marling, who also apparently she's credited as one of the creators.
Yes, I think she produces and writers, I think, yeah.
Yeah, this is her baby, very much so.
Yeah.
But we discover that Prairie meets and then is held hostage by, or held prisoner by, a doctor who's only ever named as Hap. Played by Jason Isaacs. And Hap, it turns out, is fascinated by the experiences of people who've had near-death experiences.
Yeah. Yep.
And so he's keeping them prisoner so that he can then do all manner of experiments on them. So there's 4 or 5 people being kept in his basement as basically as lab rats. And we get flashbacks to that, and then we get present day stories of Prairie telling her story as she calls herself the OA, and we finally find out what that stands for at the very end, and then as is much of the denouement of the film, you want to start throwing things through your TV screen.
And the other part to just try and describe is the way that she's trying to tutor the other people around her to come up with a series of moves and sounds that allow them to travel interdimensionally or how do I put it? Is that fair?
Well, I love the hesitant tone in your voice because you don't know. You've got no idea, have you?
Well, a very broad idea, but I couldn't. It's hard to describe.
It's because it's hard to understand.
Yes.
They don't. The big problem is she's been interviewed after the fact, and she basically said, well, I'm leaving it to the viewer to decide what it's all about, which is basically code for I haven't the faintest idea what that ending was about.
I took it to follow on from what your description, that in some way she has found a way to use the near-death experience to go out of body and travel astrally, as we saw Doctor Strange do a little while ago.
Yes.
Elsewhere, and so you're being asked to get your head around a lot in this series, and it gets a little. I was held there for quite a while because I was just curious, where the heck are they taking it? But then, when you really start to see it, the challenge of a program like this is to maintain some degree of integrity in the telling, and for the audience not to start guffawing and saying, "Oh, this is ridiculous." And I guess because they're not at all tongue in cheek. They're taking it pretty seriously, aren't they, Steve? So,
oh, very much. So.
You've either got to buy into it or not.
Well, for the first, I mean, we watched the first episode, Debbie and I watched, and we thought, "Oh, this has got a lot of potential." We watched the second and the third, and we're thinking, "Oh, we like this. This is intriguing."
Yes.
5, 6, 7, you're going, "Oh, wow, I can't wait to see where this is going." As episode 7 went on, we're going, "Yeah, okay." And by the time we got into by the time we realized that episode 8 not only wasn't going to bother tying together and explaining what was actually going on, but it was going to ask even more questions and not even have the courtesy to offer you clues on how to answer them, I was just cross in the end.
See, that's not a good thing to be left with, that feeling at the end of watching a series.
Did you not have that sense of
you've
got to be kidding me?
Yes, I thought disappointment that having invested so much in that telling to begin with, feeling like you were being led somewhere that was going to be really interesting at the end, feeling like they were approaching it as if, "We're taking this seriously. We're putting a lot of craft into this. You know, the production was pretty good. The actors did a good job. The script was kind of weird, but it kept you guessing." So there was a lot of things, as you say, that were drawing you in, but not to give you something to really – you don't have to have everything tied up in a neat bow, but you'd kind of like to feel that you feel you've been led somewhere. And this didn't quite do that.
No, it led us somewhere and they just left us there.
Yeah,
and seriously, Britt Marling, and the wonderfully named Zal Batmangli, who, seriously, I'm not making this up. They're the two creators, writers, directors. You know, they're the ones who really need to sit and have a good long think about what they've done.
Yeah,
frankly, they owe us an apology.
I don't hold your breath, Steve.
No, I'm not being realistic. Just because we deserve one doesn't mean we're going to get it.
No.
There was talk of a second series.
Well, that maybe they have to. Maybe they have to pick it up and try and sort it out.
You make a very good point.
Yes. Anyway, it's not to be utterly dismissed because there's a lot to draw you in, but, you know, just – so I wouldn't say never watch it, but just and there's so much supernatural sci-fi stuff around these days, it might totally appeal to you. But I felt disappointed by the end too. Whew. And now, Steve, there's actually quite a lot for us to be looking at over the next week or two, you know?
Well, there's a lot coming up. I don't know if we'll be able to look at it.
Yeah, okay.
You know where I'm going with that one, don't you? He says,
yeah, I know. Go on.
Adele is coming to town.
Yes, indeed.
She'll be taking up residence at Mount Smart Stadium.
Okay, yes.
Very shortly. This Thursday.
Yes.
And Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunday.
And Sunday, yes.
Absolutely, yes. 21 Pilots.
Who the aforementioned,
We mentioned earlier. They'll be at Vector Arena. They're actually, we have a double booking. Well, Auckland does, we don't. On Saturday night, 21 Pilots and Adele will be in town.
There'll be no one at home.
No, there won't. Well, there'll be you and me at home. Yes, I'm not quite sure what went wrong there, but for some reason, maybe they just can't quite handle the probing, insightful commentary that Crave provides. They just weren't quite ready for that, I don't think. That's probably the problem there.
Never mind.
So at least that's what I'm telling myself anyway.
Yeah, well, we have to be true to ourselves and do the job we were sent here to do.
Absolutely. It's their loss, Simon. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
So we've got that's the big news in concerts coming up very shortly. There's not been a huge amount of announcements out this week. No new names been announced.
Yeah.
But what is? Oh yeah, I'll tell you who is coming to town very shortly. Is Dave Dobbin.
Oh yes, some sort of grand revival tour, or no, it's not the right way to put it, revival, but he's got a lot of history he can draw on to put together a tour, that's for sure.
We'll put it this way, he's calling it the 40 Years of Hits Tour.
That sums it up rather nicely, doesn't it?
And I mean, he's playing everywhere. His tour starts in Whangarei, it ends in Invercargill.
Okay, he's got it covered.
Pretty comprehensive tour of New Zealand.
It certainly is.
He's got, and it's not just your obvious Aucklands and Wellingtons either. We've got Fielding and Wairoa and Nelson and where else have we got? Putaruru. We've got, you know, the whole lot.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's, good
he's
on him.
And he's doing this on consecutive nights as well.
Bloody hell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th. Took a couple of days off. 20th, 21st, 22nd. I mean, you know, he's going to be putting on a show, it would appear.
Yeah.
So I think that could be worth a look.
There'll be a lot of people interested to see, because he there's no doubt, Steve, you know, if you were here in the 80s and 90s, he's produced some of the great anthems of New Zealand popular music culture, and that were sung to within an inch of their lives on many occasions. So there'd be a lot of people who would like to see him again. I think they would be. Yep.
Yes. Now I'll tell you who we won't be seeing anytime mm-hmm. soon. Mm-hmm. Chuck Berry.
No.
As we are speaking, I've just had an alert pop up on my computer that he is no longer with us.
Ah. Oh. Okay, well, that's gosh. He had a lot. He had a good innings.
Oh, you would. 90 years old, apparently.
Okay.
It's just been announced in the last few minutes that he's died.
Okay. Ah, oh, well.
But to be fair, 90 and you know, what a life he's had. I mean, he did announce last year that he'll be releasing an album this year. I don't know if it ever actually came out. But he was certainly working on his first album in 38 years.
Yes, I'm just quickly. Yeah, yeah. I think it might have been even just released. I'm just having. Maybe it was about to be released. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is as breaking news as you get.
It was going to be called Chuck.
Yes.
And it was meant to be available this year. Not sure exactly what date they were hoping to release it. But anyway, there you go. Golly. Wow, Chuck Berry.
I know. I know. Breaking news on Crave. We've done political commentary. We're now doing breaking news. We need to stick to the entertainment because this is starting to sadden us a little bit.
It is.
So what's going to come and entertain us soon in the cinemas? We've got Gary of the Pacific.
Yeah, I think that's just – it's just open, and nice to have another New Zealand film to talk about and a comedy too. It looks a bit madcap, but I think I might try and catch that one, Steve.
I think we both have to see that one before next time, definitely. That'll be a good one to chew over. There's the live-action version of Beauty and the Beast.
Which, I'm kind of interested in that, only because I remember taking my daughter to see the animated version years ago when she was little, and those songs that were very memorable at the time – to see how they approach this. It's got Emma Watson in it, doesn't it?
And it's got a lot of people in it. Emma Thompson's in it.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor's in it.
Yeah, yes.
And I mean, this is a film that deals with meaty topics. You thought Broadchurch was getting dark and serious?
Yeah.
I mean, this has got bestiality. It's got Stockholm Syndrome. It's got everything.
What more could you want? Yes.
Yeah, so I know. We've also got the Japanese anime classic Ghost in the Shell.
Right, and this is—it's interesting because we were talking the other week about the Wall and or the Great Wall and how they had to bring European actor, you know, Matt Damon in.
Yes.
Well, this has got Scarlett Johansson in this film, very much set in Japanese culture. She playing the lead character, so that's another. They lost their nerve a bit at the end there, but that look—I've seen the trailer. It certainly looks very visually impressive by the look, just by a few seconds on the trailer.
Yes.
So I'm probably interested in seeing that, actually.
I think we'll definitely give it a look. And then the other one that I'm going to try and get to see, and I would recommend to you from the trailers that's opening this week, is called Get Out.
Oh.
Are you familiar?
I've seen reference to it. Just give me a quick hint of what that's about, please, Steve.
Youngish white university student in America has a black boyfriend who she's going to take home to meet the very, very, very white parents. And
is this with the, what's her name, Ruth Negga? That one?
No, no.
That's called Loving. I think that's Loving.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I know she's in something recently. I don't think it's that one. No. This apparently is a very, very dark horror comedy riff on Look Who's Coming to Dinner.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Getting very good press.
Okay. All right. That's another one on our list. We're going to be busy.
It's not like we have any concerts to go to next week.
No. Okay. We'll make up for it somehow.
We will indeed.
Excellent.
So you've been listening to Crave. We'll be back again soon with more film and maybe music.
We hope. We live in hope. In the meantime, we are very keen to hear from you. Actually, we've been getting quite a bit of traffic on the Facebook page in the last little while, which has really been nice. But if you want to email us, the email address is podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Find us on Facebook. All the cool kids are these days. Or you can follow us on Twitter @cravepodcast.
He's a cool kid. I'm Simon Mercer.
And he's an even cooler kid. And I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding.
Very good.
Yeah, that was a good one.